Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Hello and welcome back to New Books in Latino Studies. I'm David James Gonzalez, the host of the channel, and today I'm speaking with Natale Zappia, author of Traders and Raiders, The Indigenous World of the Colorado Basin, 1540 to 1859, published by the University of North Carolina Press in 2014. Dr. Zappia is an assistant professor of history at Whittier College, where he teaches early American, Native American, borderlands, and environmental history. Professor Zappia's research explores the ways that continental trading networks, food pathways, and ecologies transformed North America over the past three centuries. Dr. Zappia's research has been supported by a number of institutions, including the National Endowment for the Humanities, the Autry National Center, and the Mellon Fellowship at the Huntington Library. Hello, Nat, and welcome to New Books in Latino Studies.
Hi, DJ. Thanks for having me.
Of course. It's a pleasure. I was wondering if you could start a conversation today by telling us a little bit about yourself.
Sure. So as you mentioned, I teach at Whittier College, which is in Los Angeles, right outside Los Angeles. But I'm from the East Coast, from New York, where I went to school as an undergraduate at Cornell University. And at Cornell, I had a chance to take several courses and have as a mentor Professor Robert Venables, who taught in the American Indian Studies program there. Mm-hmm. And he was a historian, public historian, who worked with the Haudenosaunee, the Iroquois from us to New York. And as a historian for the tribe, he was consulted on numerous land claims cases, particularly amongst the Onondaga Nation, which their reservation is right in between Ithaca, New York, where Cornell is, and Syracuse. And he worked with many of the folks to on different court cases to try to help the tribe use history, essentially, use historical records and documentation to get back some land, or, you know, at least get back a recognition from the local and state and federal government. Mm-hmm. For land restitution. And taking this course has really got me obviously interested, but also really excited just fascinated with the topic of course of Native America, but more importantly about, you know, social justice issues around Indian country and how history and politics and economics collide through that narrative of Native America and the history of Native America, and how that history is so visceral and such a part of the struggles that folks across Indian country today are dealing with, and again, using history as such a powerful tool to help rectify many of these and to help address many of these long-standing issues. Mm-hmm. So as Venables, as my mentor, you know, I decided I wanted to, you know, continue pursuing that and to really think about being from Long Island, New York, never really thought about Indian country, thinking about those issues from a social justice perspective that really went beyond just Native America, but all you know, many different groups who have been oppressed or have been marginalized throughout history, throughout U.S. and early American history. And, you know, I guess I was really interested in trying to tackle those, some of those issues as a, through a historical lens.
Right.
So, so at Cornell, I worked at, a couple of different places, mostly with, again, marginalized communities, communities, at-risk communities, mostly, at-risk youth in and around New York City. And then I ended up in, working for a bit at the, on the Cheyenne River Reservation in South Dakota. And again, those issues that I mentioned that I, first was exposed to at Cornell, you know, I really saw that on the reservation and the, you know, how history, plays such a role in the lives of these folks, but also how many folks on the reservation, and across Indian country, again, were using history and you know, hiring tribal historians and other experts to help, preserve cultural legacies, but also, again, to help advance economic and political, initiatives, you know, mm-hmm. to protect Indian country, protect tribal sovereignty, and to protect environments too. So as I worked in these different areas, I increasingly became interested in, again, using the historical lens, but also thinking of the environment as well. You know, thinking about environmental racism and how that plays a role in Indian country, but also throughout, you know, in urban areas as well.
Right.
So then I went to graduate school at Santa Cruz, and I continued thinking about these things. I started a PhD program there in history, and I worked with my dissertation advisor was Elizabeth Haas, who works on very similar issues in California, Native California.
Mm-hmm.
She's written lots of works and worked a lot with several different tribes in California on re-examining the mission history and re-examining the commemoration of folks like Sarah, mm-hmm. just was canonized recently, and just really working closely with the California tribes and helping them capture and present their own indigenous history of California.
Right.
So basically, this book is really a reflection of all those experiences. And for me, history and my role as a historian ultimately is about connecting the serving communities who I'm writing about, but also getting people to think about just those really close, that history is so present. History is such a part of of the political, economic, and cultural infrastructure that we all inhabit now. And for me, Native America is one of the most illuminating ways to think about to understand that.
No, I agree so entirely. Answer,
yeah.
Well, I appreciate the answer and the, you know, your connections with the, you know, history and, you know, social justice issues. I think, you know, that's a lot of what kind of drew me to the subject matter as well. You know, I think when we look at, right, how people see the world, you know, whether you want to say that, you know, worldview, perspective, or ideology, all of that's shaped by history so much, right? And how history is told, how it's preserved, presented, et cetera, how it's interpreted. And, so definitely I see exactly where you're coming from there. What else are you going to say? No, I was going to say, go ahead. Keep going.
Oh, so it's to add to that, you know, of course, the borderlands are another such what fascinates. That's what I'm interested in borderlands history because of that. You see, for the same reason, you know, the borders, borderlands is really, that's really where the periphery, so to speak, really in many ways determines, what the heartland or the core institutions and values, you know, they spread to the borderlands and they're tested on the borderlands. And,
right.
And you really get a sense of the human communities that are impacted by them, but also are able to shape them in, you know, in unique and unexpected ways. And I think, those are the little niches that what I'm really interested in. That's what led me to this book and this case study.
Gotcha. Good. Well, how about you talk a little bit more about that, about, you know, this particular region in general? So you talked about how your interest in Native American, in environmental history kind of developed, but how did you come to determine, you know, on this region and this people?
Sure. Well, a couple of different things. The other thing that interests me about Native American history, and especially as I was thinking about a topic for my dissertation, was this notion of hidden in plain sight, you know, that there are so many aspects of our history that are just in plain sight. And I think Native American history definitely serves as one of those examples across North America, across the Americas, you know, particularly across North America, where, you know, people don't necessarily think about Native America in a sustained way.
Right.
So in that sense, what drew me to this, the Colorado River, which is really what the book is about, the lower Colorado, regionally speaking. The lower Colorado River is a waterway that's played such a huge role in the borderland history of the borderlands and history of the West, of the American West in particular, mm-hmm. and also northern Mexico. You know, it supplies, obviously, you know, a huge amount of agricultural water, right. But also it feeds cities that all the southwest cities, from Phoenix to Vegas to Los Angeles, San Diego. So, I mean, millions and millions of people rely on the dams that divert the water and the irrigation ditches and channels that divert the water. That's such a life, it's like it's a lifeblood of and not only the West, but of course, much of the food that gets produced in these places, particularly in the Imperial Valley and Northern mm-hmm. Mexico, mm-hmm. gets exported all throughout the country.
Right.
It's one of those things no one really thinks about, the Colorado River here, even during the drought. You know, now, of course, there's more thought of it, with people thinking more about water conservation now, but the Colorado River is really not, it's just kind of an afterthought.
So true, to
the mainstream. And so that really got me interested in thinking, you know, so what, just kind of thinking of not only so there's this huge weight that the Colorado River, huge shadow that looms over, if you will, looms over all these cities so many people live in, including myself. Yet the history of it really has been limited to the historical documentation, which
right.
a lot of it is obviously from the perspective of non-Native people, mm-hmm. non-Native histories. So, and much of the study, much of the work that was, and incredible work that has been done on the Colorado River, especially the kind of the early American Colorado River and colonial Colorado Rivers, has largely been done by anthropologists and archaeologists, and ethnohistorians mm-hmm. looking at, what we might say non-traditional, or usually the sources that historians don't go to first. So I saw in the Colorado River, as I was thinking about projects, as a place that's been somewhat overlooked in terms of Native history by historians, a place that's very relevant to the lives of millions of people today, but also has this long history that's been documented, it's been documented in material culture and archaeology and oral histories. So I saw an opportunity to synthesize these fields, and then also ultimately to kind of flip the narrative, to think of the Colorado River from an indigenous perspective. And to look at it from an indigenous perspective, you have to look at a much longer time frame,
mm-hmm.
a much longer historic time frame. And then that's where you have to start thinking about ecological time and thinking about the environment. So the more I thought about it, the more I realized I had a lot of work a lot of fields to try to master. And, I had to assemble my dissertation committee in ways that I might not have done otherwise, which is great. So I had the renowned archaeologist, Judith Habig-Mausch, who is an expert on proto-historic pottery in the Southwest, who really helped me get me grounded in the literature on you know, on material culture and archaeology and how to read a you know, how to even read archaeological reports and
right.
Just how to understand the vast field of literature on trade on pre-contact trade and those kinds of things. So and then so that allowed me to and I also had to have you know I had to understand you know colonial Latin America. You know, colonial American history, particularly borderline lands history,
right?
And get grounded in not only, of course, in the English language historiography, but also Spanish language historiography. And so it was one of those things that just kept so much piling on, but also it made it more interesting and more fascinating for me. And you know, ultimately, I chose to take a big picture approach to the project. You know, that has its downsides, but I think, again, when you think of the Colorado River and this period, you have to have this, you have to have a larger, wider, lens.
Right. Right. And it's, you know, that you, certainly comes across in your narrative and, in how you describe this interior world, you know, the pre-Columbian interior world, and then how the book tracks it, right? Tracks the development of, you know, the political economy, the social relations of, you know, both the indigenous groups, and then as well as their interactions with others, you know, throughout this interior world that now, right, encompasses essentially, six modern, U.S. states and, you know, parts of Mexico, including, right, Baja California and, the northern states of the main, portions.
Exactly. And all those indigenous nations, you know, recognized by the U.S. in particular, that live along Colorado River that have unique, water rights. You know, they have water rights that are different than their relationship with the state and federal government. You know, Indian nations have treaty, you know, have different treaties that allow them, different kinds of access or lack of access depending on the situation. But you know, that are kind of a government to government relationship that are, really, well, that's what fascinated me. Again, it's this idea of the present that you look at the Colorado River, the Little Colorado, and you could see all these, indigenous groups, they are still there, you know.
Right.
I mean, they were, you know, that many, and this is part of the book is about, you know, the Spanish trying to colonize and then Mexico and then the U.S., you know, especially the U.S. trying to remove different indigenous groups, and they couldn't do it. They just weren't able to, for all sorts of reasons, but
right.
The important thing is that they couldn't do it, that they're there still, and that they're able to assert the relative degree of political and economic power or autonomy, at least. Which, when you think of how important the Colorado River is now, it's not inconsequential or insignificant.
No, that's so true. So, and your point there, you said a while back, you know, that you referred to the Colorado River as kind of the prize of the region, and. You know, I appreciate that because I didn't really think of that, of course. You know, when we look at the land that was, you know, the land cession from Mexico, oftentimes we speak so much about the gold, right? And of course these weren't things that were known when the land was ceded. They were kind of latter developments. But if you're looking at the two prizes, right, you got gold in the Sierras and then you have a river. Now the Colorado River probably, functioned or factioned, fit more into maybe considerations on that land session. I'm not really sure. The gold itself was really, you know, not known at the time, but, I think that's a great perspective you know, I think it's one of the lenses that I appreciate that environmental history and ecological history provides, right? It helps us to show, cause you can see as you track over the, what is it we're covering in this book, a little over 300 years, but, you know, fast forward 500 years, how vital the region still is because of the, you know, the river. Great point.
Yeah, I think that what makes it also interesting, I think, is you mentioned, you know, of course, goal, you know, the conquistador, you know, the conquistador mindset, right? Which is obviously simplistic phrase, right? But there was, you know, early colonization in Latin America, you know, there was that element, right? And I think what makes, for me, the Colorado River interesting is 1540. I mean, that's right at the beginning. That's early. You know, this is early period of colonization for Spain, and the fact that the Colorado River was recognized as a strategic choke point, a strategic place that, you know, and a lot of it, obviously, it's like you said, the rivers are always seen that way, the rivers that connect the oceans. But, you know, what made it important is the earliest explorers, Spanish explorers, you know, saw the vibrant trade, they saw the markets, the indigenous markets, and they recognized that there was a there, you know, there was something that they could tap into. And that's what makes it important. It always was strategic, in one way or the other.
So right.
Part of my argument is it's not that this place was just discovered by, you know, Europeans or non-native people late in the game because it's so far west, and, you know, that's why the native people were able to withstand some of the onslaught of colonialism, or that's why they're still here because it happened later. They were, you know, this is one of the earliest, you know, in the 16th century, so this is really early on, and usually that early encounter equates to demographic decline, cultural clashes, et cetera. But in this instance, you see, you know, in some ways, very different interaction, or comparable to other parts where Native people were able to maintain their autonomy and also exert some power, of course, thing is any Native groups who were engaged in the fur trade, you know, again, the Haudenosaunee, the Iroquois, the Comanches later on, you know, the Cherokees, there are certain Native groups that were able to really, that knew how to work these different colonial powers against each other.
Right, right.
And, you know, in some ways there's a comparison that I draw. In other ways, it was unique, I think, in the sense there wasn't any indigenous state or indigenous empire or indigenous group that controlled everything.
Right.
Such a diverse, culturally diverse, linguistically diverse, economically diverse place, and environmentally such a dynamic place that, you know, migration and movement and all of these resulting trading networks that evolved as a result of that really determined the way people were going to interact with each other, whether you're indigenous or not.
And let's talk about, I think, that a bit more. We've talked about how the you introduced us to the interior world, the pre-Columbian interior world, and how the rivers, the Colorado River, the Gila River, really the basis of the networks and the relationships that exist among and that are formed amongst, you know, this very diverse inner region, an expansive region, right? So can you talk more about what the interior world looked like, you know, like its social geography? What were some of the people, the relationships, and, you know, food systems, mobility, those types of things that existed in this world in the pre-Columbian era?
Sure. Yeah, this is the first chapter of the book, which took the longest and is the longest in the book. And for me, in many ways, it really sets the tone for the rest of it set the grooves, if you will, the ecological, cultural, economic grooves that really determine the patterns of interaction post Columbus, in a post Columbian world. And so, it was really defined. I mean, you know, I start the book, you know, even though the book's, the title is 1540 to 1859, I really start, my first chapter starts in the 13th to 14th century, where you have something called the Little Ice Age, the global phenomenon, which you have a kind of a cooling of the planet, and as a result, you have these different environmental changes across the globe. And in the Southwest, what you had was an increasingly drier place. You have the shrinking of lakes and diversion of rivers, and you, so therefore you have the movement of people dispersed across a wider territory. Where, you know, so groups that have lived around what is now the Salton Sea, some of these indigenous groups now are, you know, living farther and farther apart due to environmental changes, and as a result of some environmental changes, also engaging in different forms of production and trade. So what the world was like, this interior world was like, was dynamic. It was still, again, migrations, people, mobile communities moving in different directions. You have the reliance, great reliance on kind of niche products depending on the environment. So you have a huge amount of literally millions of shell beads, which were produced on the Channel Islands.
Right.
And used as a form of currency. And, you know, and one of the things I do in the book, I try to, and just a sliver, really, document some of the larger archaeological sites that, you know, find tens of thousands of beads at some of these, whether grave sites or just villages, right, that are being excavated, pre-contact, pre-Columbian indigenous villages, and you see these beads, you see them in California, of course, you see them up and down the coast. You see them as far east as Texas,
well
into Baja and Sonora and Sinaloa. So you see, you know, you see these beads that come from the Channel Islands being traded, across these distances and in large numbers. So
did they probably serve like a as a currency? You know, what was the desire, you know, for these beads, you know, as you know, in this vast expanse that you're explaining here?
Yeah. I mean, this is one of the questions that archaeologists are, you know, they're still looking at it, and increasingly, you know, dependent on the short answer is dependent on the indigenous group. So you can see the Chumash, for instance, who, and the Tongva, but particularly the Chumash, who were the producers of these. You know, this was their territory. They controlled the production of these beads. And, you know, and when I say shell beads, I point that out in the book, is we're talking about really, really, we're talking about precision. We're talking about mechanized, you know, they're all handmade, obviously, but, you know, mechanized labor.
They're drilled,
regimented,
right?
Yeah, drilled. They're drilled. You know, and when you go on the shoreline of the Channel Islands, you can just see the, you know, the remnants and the kind of of just millions of drills, micro beads and micro drill beads, and all kinds of products related to the production of that. So, you know, over a sustained period of time, people who are doing that, you know, and one bead would take, you know, takes several hours to make, and the beads are, you know, are a couple of millimeters,
tiny.
A couple of millimeters, so small. They're precise, they're very uniform. So then again, you look at them as an example, where you look at the material culture, and you could, you know, without being too speculative, you can see these are folks who are producing these for because of demand, you know,
right.
Not just simply
preciosity
or simply a, you know, ornamental. I mean, obviously it's ornamental, but it's used as a way to link cultures as well. So there are different standardization, you know, different archaeologists have pointed to different measures of standardization. So, and a lot of those, so there are records in the Spanish colonial documents that say, you know, Mojaves, for instance, who are from, you know, from close to the Colorado River, would encounter Spanish Franciscans and talk about trading beads that would, you know, one horse would equal roughly a string of beads going from your elbow to your middle finger. So it's like, you know, you could actually see a you know, some kind of standardization.
Right.
And I'm not saying that, I don't think anyone is saying that it was like, you know, I mentioned there was a currency that everyone followed, but
right.
there was a conversation. There was a sophistication and a complexity that was not unlike many other parts of the early modern world. You know, and I think this book is really an argument that tries to meet this indigenous history on the same terms that you would meet other early modern histories.
Right.
Whether it be Europe, Africa, Asia, you know, and that's part of the critique is that somehow that history was, you know, not as, you know, just because it wasn't as well documented, therefore you can't really draw those conclusions when
right.
you know, you actually can if you look at a lot of the material culture.
No, so, it's
so beads
true,
are one example. But,
right, beads, it makes sense. Right,
yeah,
textiles, so, grasses, pottery. I mean, and you mentioned these things
right,
are mass-produced
exactly.
commodities within
exactly.
this
I mean,
interior world, right?
Yeah. I mean, the baskets are a great example because it's such a – baskets are, to me, the most fascinating because there's a Native California Basket Weavers Association. I mean, is an incredible, you know, incredibly vibrant art form that's alive and well across Native
mm-hmm.
California.
Mm-hmm.
And the baskets, you know, it's just, I document some of this, and a lot of the stuff again is in the book. I draw on archaeologists and ecologists and folks who are looking at folks who are working with the tribes and folks who are again looking at the material culture. So none of it, you know, a lot of this stuff is admittedly, you know, I'm just pointing it out, you know, kind of just bringing it into the historical record in
right,
a way.
Right. Exactly.
And but the baskets are fascinating because you have. Again, it's such a, they're so versatile. I mean, there are mm-hmm. dozens of different types of baskets, and I have a table in the book that just highlights a few of them.
Right.
You know, that are watertight, that can be used for all kinds of things, and they're lighter, lightweight, and that you could carry goods in over long, long distances. Because that's
right.
the other thing. We're talking about vast distances, hundreds of miles,
mm-hmm.
that people are carrying stuff, on foot because they were, you know, in the pre-Columbian world, there weren't any draft animals or horses
right.
In this part of the continent. So that, and of course, this from a hot, dry, desolate place, the Mojave Desert, one of the most desolate places on the planet.
Mm-hmm.
And yet you have an incredible instance, or an incredible amount, rather, of petroglyphs and rock art that's been documented. It's just to show how many people were traveling through there and using it for, you know, primarily the petroglyphs are, you know, they are indicative of spiritual, you know, the spiritual meaning that many non-native people will never have access to. But, you know, a lot of those, there are other rocks, there are other petroglyphs that point to watering holes or point to places you can, you know, find certain kinds of grasses, you know, almost places that help traveler along, type of, you know, that kind of
right.
that kind of message, you know, if you will. So in that way, you know, that you see that you can see those same kinds of things happen, you know, in the Silk Road, you know, or other kinds of long distance
overland right.
trading networks.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So, and again, it's not to equate the two, but it's just to show that, you know, these are similar kinds of human communities that are experiencing this early modern world, that are shaping this early modern world. So,
right.
so yeah, and baskets were amazing because just the amount of, I mean, you know, many times baskets, and until recently, basket weaving we've seen is almost, it's like a craft almost, not really a, yeah, an art, you know, you think of baskets, you know, it's, and again, it's just like that, it's like that stereotype that, you know, needs to be dismantled, right?
Right.
And I think, the thing about baskets, you have to, not only do you have to, burn selectively certain types of grasses so that the right ones grow, the ones that you could bend and use, like deer grass, for instance. Then you have to harvest them in a certain way. Then you have to harvest, you know, hundreds of them. I don't have the numbers offhand. I do have them in the book, though, for one basket. You know, hundreds and hundreds of blades of grass have to be harvested.
Right.
And then you have to weave them. So, and you can imagine the labor and the, the organization of communities around
exactly,
that.
Exactly, right. Yeah, so. The organization it took to do it.
Oh, yeah, exactly. Right.
I mean, exactly. I need to mention to grow it, to grow the specific blade of grass, right? And then,
right.
And then
exactly.
to harvest it, right? And then to dry it out. And then, exactly. you know, so just the various stages that are involved in producing,
yeah.
You know, this object,
exactly.
right? And it's certainly, exactly. and viewed in that way, you totally now see, like you see, dispel the myth that this is just some neat type of craft where this is a desired commodity, a commodity
exactly.
that is, you know, very useful when you're traveling, say, from San Diego
right.
to,
right.
you know, either southern Utah or the southwestern,
yeah.
you know, corner, the Four Corners area, right?
Right?
It's,
right.
you would see why this is so desirable. Certainly. Certainly, certainly.
I mean, you, you know, not to go off on a tangent, but you just remind me of one of the other, just to follow up with this, your initial question about, you know, how I came up with this idea. And I mentioned the Colorado River. So in graduate school, I had a chance to read James Brooks's wonderful book, Captains and Cousins, which prize-winning book, which looked at the evolution and expansion of borderlands slavery in New Mexico, and really cut across indigenous and Spanish and Mexican and American communities. And what I love about the book, one of the things I love about the book are the maps. And one particular map showed a trail called the Old Spanish Trail, which mm-hmm. connected Santa Fe with Los Angeles. And I got me thinking about, again, we've been talking about this idea of goods and indigenous commodities, but also indigenous space. You know, what does that look like? And was the Old Spanish Trail actually an old, you know, an indigenous trail? And how, you know, what does that say about migration and movement and again, and the role of native autonomies in shaping Spanish colonial economies and then mm-hmm. later Mexican economies and American economies. So I started doing a little more digging into that Old Spanish Trail, and what I found actually was really fascinating. One of the things I found is that there's this following the Old Spanish Trail Association, which commemorates the, you know, the beginning of this trail, just like other groups commemorate the Lewis and Clark Trail or the
right.
old Santa
mm-hmm.
Fe Trail. So there's that kind of culture of commemoration. And in fact, it was just recently George W. Bush signed an act called the Old Spanish Trail Preservation Act or something like that. And basically the idea was to make it a national historic trail, and then it gets some, you know, protection, and it gets certain types of funding, and it allows people to keep the trail alive and keep,
right.
keep the memory of the trail alive. And the reason I bring that up is just to, you know, again, it hammers in that idea of the importance of public commemoration and getting that history, re-examining the history of these borderlands. Many times happens through the public first, the monuments, and then the historians come after sometimes.
Right. Right. I agree. I can hear you fine. And
I got a helicopter overhead.
Oh, that's
hopefully
fine.
You can edit that out.
That's fine.
Of course.
Well, you know, you started to mention, in addition to, you know, the importance of public history, as I see, the one thing even in that is sometimes lost in public history, even in commemoration and whatnot, particularly when we're looking at indigenous Americans,
yeah,
indigenous
right.
communities and societies, is the influence they had on the region even after
exactly.
so-called contact, right? So you started to
right.
talk about how, you know, the indigenous networks and relationships of the interior world, and this is right the subjects of, you know, say the middle of the book, how those networks and relationships shape, you know, the early colonial and then, you know, emerging Mexican state and American state economies. Can you talk about that a bit more, about just how, you know, just influential the both the trading networks and the relationships as well as the commodities produced by the indigenous within the interior world were on the emerging, you know, Pacific Rim trade and, you know, other, you know,
sure.
transcontinental trade, et cetera.
Sure. I argue that they have an enormous impact. And one of the reasons is just because of the you know, it's there's no denying that this region is climate is harsh, and you can't really stray off the path. You know, your life would, you know, your life is at stake if you're if you run out of water, or, you know, yeah. And the thing about Europeans, of course, they bring their animals, animals need grass, they need water, and that limits their, you know, that puts them on a very predictable path to get from one mission to the next, or one town to the next.
Right.
And so what you start seeing, and of course, and those roads that they used were pre-Columbian, many of them were pre-Columbian indigenous roads, because they were also connected along like water sources and places you can get food and shelter, et cetera. So that automatically set up just the space. So these colonial economies really were inhabiting an indigenous space, just that alone. And then, of course, then you have the fact that, the fact that these colonial economies also, of course, depended on indigenous labor to produce crops and raise the animals. And they're in these very isolated, in particular Sonora, for instance, you know, very isolated places, the Spanish missions were, that were the majority of people were from different indigenous communities, sometimes friendly and sometimes enemies.
Mm-hmm.
And so there was this complex intercultural world that many Jesuits and Franciscans had to navigate, and some did well, and many didn't. And then the other thing that really, where you see this real presence and importance of indigenous influence on these kind of this early colonialism, or at least on the Spanish settlements, because in many cases there wasn't any colonialism. There's just attempts to settle.
Right.
And what you see is the role of increasingly of borderlands slavery, and the native people started getting access and wanting European products, like, for instance, wheat.
Mm-hmm.
So you have many native groups, particularly along the Colorado River, where you have the predictable water source. The Quichons, for instance, were major indigenous group. They grew wheat, and they grew it pretty well. In fact, they still grow wheat today, wheat and cotton on their land.
Mm-hmm.
So and of course horses and particularly horses, but also cattle and sheep. You see that throughout the borderlands, being not only a tool for Spanish expansion, but also indigenous expansions. You know, you have the Navajos, who become really powerful. They have really powerful pastoral economies, sheep herders, and other borderlands, and also the borderlands I talk about. Horse, you have a kind of a captive raiding of both native and non-native, particularly, you know, primarily women and children from these towns, and raided on horseback. So you have an expansion of this kind of horse for people, you know, the trade, but also the horses enable that, the expansion of that. So these European tools are being adopted by native people and shaping, because of that borderlands expansion of these indigenous borderlands through this captivity network. You have European, Spanish, and later Mexicans and Americans having to, you know, when they try to subdue it, they can't, you know, they don't have that power. And you see that in California as well. The California economy was constantly under threat from these raiders, hence the title Traders and Raiders.
Right.
So, you know, these raiders that are coming from the Colorado River, and you have a lot of documentation on just the preoccupation with particularly Mojave raiders coming, and the Mojaves were blamed, and the Utes were blamed for many of these raids.
Right.
In truth, there are many, many groups that were involved in it. but they would go and poach some of the missions and the ranchos later on in the basin, the LA basin, and in San Diego as well. So that's an indigenous centered or an indigenous, you know, influenced economy. That's driven by native needs and desires and cultural values, et cetera. But of course, it's not truly indigenous in a way. It's a borderlands.
Right.
A borderlands in the sense, because again, these are non-native goods and animals. And of course, many Spaniards and later Mexicans and Americans benefited from captives, you know, had their own captives and took part in the trade. So,
right, and where you really see the borderlands framework, I think, working very well. I mean, you focus particularly on these two very important tools, right? Trading and raiding. And so, part of the, you know, that raiding was, you know, for the purpose of obtaining captives. And you discuss in the earlier part of the book how captivity, you know, of course, was a feature of pre-Columbian society, and it worked more along the forms of diplomacy. Yet, it transitions to a commodity as, you know, the borderlands economy develops, right? Yeah. Can you talk a bit more about that transition, about how central, because I think it's, you know, a lot of this speaks to the stereotypes, you know, of Native America and, you know, indigenous societies that, you know, how we see them represented in popular, you know, either movies or other types of, you know, popular you know, products or representations that, you know, that's what Indians did, right? They were warriors and they were raiders they stole people and they were just brutal.
Right.
But, captivity again was a very important part and feature of this economy. And there was, so they were feeling a desire and a need. So can you talk a bit more about that?
Yeah. I think that's a great point. Yeah. I think this is where like a comparative lens is. So, you know, I'm a huge fan of that as comparative, you know, thinking of comparative history. Because especially during this time period, because you could see similar parts, you could see the kind of, you know, borderland slavery, captivity, the idea of captivity and diplomacy as being so central to so many parts of the world, not just Native America. Any places that were not controlled by a state, you know, that were on the edges, were on the borderlands. You can see this, of course, throughout West African societies and, you can even see it in parts of Europe. You could see that in, you know, throughout, you know, throughout Asia. And, so this is an economic and political, it's a political economic, tool or device or, convention that you see in many parts of the world. So in that sense, it first of all, it debunks the stereotype that natives were somehow uniquely, as you said, you know, that they had the monopoly on this, or that this, they invented this, or that this is what they were all about. And so you see, you know, the first thing you say is, well, it's happening in all other parts, all the borderlands across the planet.
Right.
But the other thing is that, the commodification part is what's key, is that Native communities were also, you know, human communities that were being drawn in to this kind of expanding, more regimented, for lack of a better word, capitalist world system. You know, I'm painting a broad brush here, but there is the idea of markets, global markets, and demand and population, all these things going hand in hand to, you know, increase the demand for certain types of products, and the people to produce many of those products. So I think, you see that in borderlands, and of course in you see that in child slavery. That's the most obvious, example of that. But so I feel like that, you know, one of the arguments I was trying to make is to tell a story of these indigenous communities as communities, as individual communities, just like other borderlands communities that were getting swept up in this, you know, they took this economic turn, this political turn. Part of it was defensive, but part of it was also about expanding, their economic, or political influence. And then once the choice is made, it just kind of fed on itself. It fed on, mm-hmm. you know, it reverberated and expanded very, very rapidly.
Right.
So, and you can see that throughout history, that, you know, history is not inevitable, that there, you know, there are choices that once they're made, it takes you down a certain path.
Right.
And, societies fall, you know, rise and fall around, and communities disappear or thrive as a result of it. So, you know, so much of what I'm trying to do in this book is really, again, as I said before, just to treat these actors as, you know, as historical figures, historical communities that lived in a certain time and a certain place, and were influenced by these long-standing indigenous time and space, but also were becoming, like every other part of the world, swept up into this global, you know, now we now live in a globalized society.
Right.
Especially when you talk about the economy and food systems, as you mentioned before, you know, you start seeing that as well.
Right. And as you're saying, you point out in the book, what they're experiencing on the ground here is, you know, as a result of being, you know, drawn into or incorporated, whatever you want to say, into a more this global system that is emerging, is you have things like land encroachment, food shortages, disease, so population decline.
Right.
All these are, you know, these are factors that are really driving the need for labor in this region as more people are coming to it. You know, again, we're taking a long breadth of, you know, view of time here, 300 years, but increasingly that's what's happening, right? More people are coming into and settling the region and disrupting existing, you know, livelihoods and you know, net trade networks and the production of certain commodities, right? So you have this thing, you mentioned livestock, and livestock's a huge thing, right? You have just an eradication of grazing lands and waterways and things of that sort, right? And so this is really a strategic type of development, right? In taking existing practice and in ways, captivity continued to be used as, you know, in diplomatic situations.
Sure.
But, really the transition you explain is, you know, this drive for the need for labor, you know, really makes it, a commodity that is being then serviced by, you know, this economy and thereby the rating. And so that's why it's a key feature of the rating. You have the captivity and then you have the livestock rating is the other portion of it, right?
Exactly. I think, you really hit it. The one thing I should say, it's important to, I mean, to think about this story, I mean, it's true. There is a, you know, the problem with the way Native American history is told, and taught especially, even with folks who are sympathetic to the Native story, so to speak, there is a, you know, there's an air of inevitability, because after all, we don't live in Comanche area. We don't live in an interior world. You know,
exactly.
We live in, you know, United States, right? We don't even live in the borderlands. We live in, people argue that there are, obviously, like LA is a cultural borderlands in many ways. But the political economic framework we're in right now is this nation state, the United States, right?
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, we think that that's the, you know, people have argued, that we're, you know, we reached the end of history, right? That's kind of, this is where we're at. And this is it. And obviously that's being upended. And I think what's important about it being upended for all kinds of reasons is Native America itself is still, you know, Native America is still here. There's a history that's still unfolding. It's uneven in terms of, you know, where you are in Indian country in terms of how well Native people are experiencing some economic revival or cultural revival, but it's happening across Indian country. And that's a completely different story, you know, so a completely different, and that is that is so profound. I mean, who knows what people will say in 100 or 200 years, but it's a profound, it forces us to, the historians, to kind of try to shy away from, or at least try to be careful around that idea of, yes, natives, they fought, you know, they were able to hold off, you know, forces of modernity, but then they succumb to it.
Right.
And I think what I like about my story is, yes, there is that aspect. Again, you just look at the political reality, economic reality, but
and demographic reality,
all the
right?
Demographic reality as well. But the fact that you can't discount the fact that these indigenous groups who have been here, meaning the Colorado River region, for 500 years or more.
Right.
Because many of them didn't show up there until these droughts and the fertilized.
Right.
So it wasn't that they were there forever.
Right.
You know, mm-hmm. That's inaccurate to say that as well.
Right.
But so they were there, they've been here, and they're still there because they were able to hold off and they were able to accomplish an extraordinary feat, which is to not be removed and also to survive and also to survive and hold on to an incredibly vitally strategic part of the, of the U.S. economy, right? That's,
right.
The Colorado River. That's something that should be, and I'm not trying to exaggerate that, but there's something that's really important about that. That's, it makes you hold the history. It tries to help you shy away from the inevitability.
Story. Yes, yes, yes.
For a specific example in the book, I talk about the Quichon Revolt,
mm-hmm.
which occurred
mm-hmm.
in the 1780s in the Colorado River, and this is an example of Spanish, using their colonial model, which was with the missions, the Franciscan in particular missionaries, to establish the towns, kind of the anchors for expansion. And they were invited. Garces, who was the Franciscan priest who established two missions
mm-hmm.
on the Colorado River in the Quechan territory, he was invited by Quechan leaders. It wasn't that he just showed up. They wanted him there, and they wanted him there because they wanted Spanish goods. They wanted to get into that. Their enemies, the Maricopas and the Odom, these other indigenous groups, they were getting access to Spanish goods, horses, crops, et cetera. And they wanted to have access to that. So they invited them in. And then they realized they were not useful to them. Spanish mm-hmm. were not useful. And then they basically burned their missions down and killed Garces and captured the rest of the folks, ultimately traded off, gave them back to the Spanish, the captives, but they rejected that Spanish model.
Right.
They retained, and they were able to hold on to, they were never colonized by the Spanish. They were never colonized by Mexico. And it wasn't until the 1850s, they're still here today. They're still right where they were when the Spanish came. So that's an important story. It's an important story to tell, I think.
No, I agree. And I appreciate you making that point because that's typically how I think of, when I'm reading, works like yours in borderland studies, and it's the trouble with how to write bookend the study, right? That does not fall into
exactly.
the inevitable decline.
Yeah.
The population is lost. It's gone. That type of, typical inevitable turn that a lot of the more the traditional narratives that take, although academic scholarship pushes back against that. And so I appreciate you, how you're bringing up that. Yes, that is a key point to bring out. There's certainly been a change in how these people have had to live their lives. Of course, that was nothing new. These people were fluid. Their societies were fluid. They're evolving. They were adaptive. But the point that, yes, they are still there. Brings up a whole other question that there is now then so much more scholarship, right, that needs to be done on these people, to now bridge, and I'm sure that's being done in various ways, but that then bridges, the mid-19th century. A lot of these studies just kind of end in the mid-19th century.
Yeah.
or yeah. late 19th century even, to, you know, the yeah. present. You know, what have the communities yeah. been doing now? And you started to mention some yeah. of these social justice issues at the beginning of our conversation yeah. that you're involved yeah. with and working with them. That's the history that's going on right now. Is that right?
Exactly. Yeah, exactly. I mean, what's amazing, what's exciting now is there is actually a flourishing, and particularly in Native studies. You know, historians are catching up 20th century. I mean, there's been many, many great 20th century studies of Indian country, all different tribes. But I think Native studies and kind of indigeneity and thinking about indigenous archives and sources, mm-hmm. It's really flourishing. I think there's a lot of, you know, theoretically, especially, I think there's lots of folks, Native scholars in particular, who are right. advancing and forcing not just historians, but people who are, you know, museum curators and not right. forcing is not a good word, you know, facilitating the re-examination mm-hmm. of collections and exhibits and monuments. I think this is where the frontier as they were, but this is where the next phase of scholarship and of understanding right. about Native history is the public part, the commemoration part.
Right.
I think
right.
ultimately, and for any history, this is where Native history isn't unique, but again, I think it's particularly so because of this particular history that, there is, and because of the government to government relationship, mm-hmm. that misinformation and kind of myths and instead of history misinforms political decisions by Congress, Supreme right. Court, policymakers, right. et cetera, who rely on, you know, who aren't relying on good history
right.
In some cases. So no, I think this is where the implications are huge for Native America, but also for all of Americans, you know,
right.
I think, again, you could see this in other groups of Americans, right?
That exactly.
are seeking right. to, seeking restoration, you know, things, restorative justice, seeking reparations, whatever it might be, but using history, good history, as a way to do that.
I agree fully. It's, I think yeah. I view it more as, to some extent, I'm trying to figure out how to word this too. I cringe at times when, just when I think of how things, you know, subfields say like, you know, Native American history or my field, Latino studies, Chicano studies, whatnot, how these things are kind of compartmentalized and at times viewed outside of, you know, U.S. history. Yeah, or their field, you know, it's so for example,
right.
to explain what you do,
exactly.
someone's like, oh, you're a Native American historian. You're
right.
you're
right.
not necessarily
right.
an American historian, right? And
right.
and my
exactly.
kind of view is, well, the way history has typically been done, it's all like ethnic history, right? I mean, if you're studying
right.
colonial
that's
America
right.
on the Eastern Seaboard and it's, you're
right.
studying the founding of the, you know, the founding fathers of the Constitution, that's ethnic history, right? Because you're covering
right. exactly.
just one group a lot
exactly.
of times. And so anyways,
exactly.
the bigger point I'm trying to make is that, yes, this all forms and it's important. Good history, helps to revise the national narrative and to revise it
yeah.
accurately, right? Not this,
yeah.
these aren't necessarily political projects, but these are really viewing this land, whether it's North America broadly,
yeah.
and the parts that eventually become the nation state of the United States or Mexico or whatever not,
yeah.
but as the histories, these collective histories that they really are. And so it takes all this research and good history, good in-depth study. And you're right.
Yeah.
Unfortunately, it takes time for it to bubble up to the surface. But, you know, hopefully studies like yours and others, they are doing that, you know, and you see them in public history commemorations,
yeah.
you know, in monument building. And maybe that's the
yeah.
way it starts. And then it gets into K-12 curriculum and fizzles
yes,
its way up,
absolutely.
Hopefully, you know? I mean,
yeah.
I hate the idea of trickle-up
yeah,
history, but...
exactly. No, I think it's so... I mean, I think... Yeah, I think it goes both ways. So I think, you know, good... Unfortunately, good scholarship has trickled down, so to speak, to some of the cultural institutions, you know, museums, et cetera.
Mm-hmm.
But also, you know, there is a trickle-up effect, too, I think, where, you know, you can... scholars in public can meet halfway
right,
some of these things because, you know, ultimately it's larger than just scholarship, right? It's larger than telling the right story.
Exactly.
It's going to be the vehicle for for the transformation. And for the U.S. to, the United States has to live up to, you mentioned the founding fathers, right? And the sort of founding list, for us to as folks living, who are citizens and living in the United States, to need to address these historical injustices, because we'll never get beyond that until you address it.
Right.
And to address, you need to have the right history, or not necessarily the right history, but the better informed, more inclusive history.
Right.
And then that allows for that healing, and allows for for some of that. There are some very real, sometimes economic, reparations of in one form or the other that need to happen. Mm-hmm. For us to address these kinds of, whether it's like in South Africa, Truth and Reconciliation Commission, that kind of thing. I think that's a good way to, that's a great model for addressing the historical, the past, and then also creating some lasting change.
Right.
There's the great model. I mean, Germany is a great example of a society that's, not perfectly, but has, faced up to the history. But, whenever you walk around, I've never been to Berlin, but many people who've talked about this say, you go around Berlin, you can't go more than 100 feet without seeing some type of monument to, the Nazi genocide,
Really?
And, there's a way that the culture has tried to address, again, not perfectly, but address in ways that the U.S. has not addressed.
Right.
Native America, slavery, immigration, the immigration issues, et cetera. And it kind of just trickles up the policies in that way as well.
And that there's a way to do that effectively that gets past, the hesitance that comes with, this history promotes guilt, right? Like this historical guilt, as if I'm somehow responsible for what happened 300 years ago. But that's a lot of the pushback that we get from this history. And what do you mean? Why do we need to address this issue now?
Right.
Shouldn't we just leave it under the rug? Do you just want to make me feel guilty and that type of perspective, I think is, as this is kind of one of those books that shows, right? As people have intermixed over, 300, 500, 1,000 years or so, I think we can get beyond the whole guilt part of it, right? It's part of the history and getting the historical record correct and more accurate, if you will, is about moving beyond all of that, right? You said, and really viewing each other as much more broadly as
reconciliation. I think reconciliation is a good
word. That's a great word. You're right.
It's a good word because it's more than just, peace and harmony. It's not about, but it's not guilt. You're right. Guilt is a debilitating, doesn't do anything.
Polarizing.
Obviously you have guilt, in a court of law. We have a adversarial court. That's how our court system, our legal system is framed. That makes sense. So there is that. But beyond that, I think, guilt is, it allows you to turn your head because you don't want to feel guilty. Right. Reconciliation, like I said, is
great point.
A good
great word
to, transcends it. It transcends it.
I agree.
Yeah.
I agree. Well, thanks so much for, this was just a great conversation. I really appreciate it.
Thank you. Appreciate it. I'm honored to talk.
And before we wrapped up entirely, I just want to give you a moment. I know this project has been done for a little while, and I know you have new things on the horizon. Just, if you don't mind, just take a minute or two and talk about what is it you're working on now?
Sure. Well, I was thinking about retiring after I have this interview. I think I'll be able to sell as many books as ever wanted. Thanks to you. seriously, it's two things. One, I'm working on a book right now called Food Frontiers. Mm-hmm. Borderland ecologies in indigenous and Euro-America. So it's basically picks up from where this book left off, in terms of thinking about the borderlands, of course, but thinking about how food systems in particular, shaped yeah, food, think about food systems as a lens. And when I say food systems, I mean not just the food products, but the infrastructure, the kind of consumption and demand cycle, you know, consumption and production cycle, if you will.
Mm-hmm.
The roads, again, the infrastructure, the technology, and the kind of particular regional climate, let's say the ecology. That's kind of how a food system operates.
You know, right.
So every city or every region has a food system. And now, of course, we're part of a global food system as well.
Mm-hmm,
So I'm interested in looking at the evolution of that and thinking about North America in particular, colonial or early American, pre-industrial, if you will, in North America through that lens, the food system lens. And what you see is you see a flipping of some narratives again. You see how indigenous producers and borderland communities are able to dictate certain political economic relationships. You see different direction of food products and technology going in certain directions that kind of counter some of the narrative of east to west, you know, that U.S. narrative. So it allows you to access, and then of course it speaks to today, you know, food and food systems and the environment are such a, you know, it's such a timely, obviously it's always timely, but it's on the minds of everyone when thinking about water and thinking about how our consumption patterns are shaping the ecology of the planet and how we need to rethink that. So in some ways it's kind of how I have an eye on some of the contemporary policy issues, but using that historical lens to think about that. Because there's been tons of stuff written about modern food systems, you know, kind of the post-war to industrial. So it's kind of looking at, really thinking about, well, what did North America and the world look like before that? You know, were there similar patterns of exchange, and what does it tell us about those patterns? Uh-huh. So that's kind of that's the one thing. Another thing I'm working on is more directly related to this book in some ways, it's actually a collaboration with my dissertation advisor, Lisbeth Haas, who, as I mentioned before, she's been doing really wonderful work on Native California. And we're trying to put together a series of essays by different scholars who look at these issues we've been talking about, indigenous, Native studies, indigenous history, and asking the question about, you know, about indigenous archives. How can we tell more inclusive, better histories about Native America through the archives? How do we use archives? How do we think of the archives as more, you know, a more copious way of understanding the archives, a more inclusive way of understanding the archives?
Mm-hmm.
So that's the kind of question we're asking, and hopefully we're going to get to a bunch of folks who are at the cutting edge that are working on these things. And have a great theoretically driven book around that, series of essays around that.
Oh,
those
great,
are the two things that I'm working on right now.
Well, they both sound fascinating, and particularly the formation of an indigenous archive and it really gets at the root of your book, right? Getting switching that that European to indigenous periphery, right? To core, you have the core, indigenous periphery, and flipping that around,
exactly.
Right? To indigenous core,
exactly.
European periphery,
exactly.
Right? And that's very difficult with the scant record, we consider records at least in our European very imperialist inflected mindsets. That's
exactly.
True. So that sounds like a great project, and Nat, just want to thank you again for coming on to New Books on Latino Studies, taking time out of your day to discuss Traitors and Raiders. We appreciate it. It's a great book, and thanks again for your time.
Thank you, and thanks for your great work.
Thanks again for tuning in to New Books in Latino Studies. I'm David James Gonzalez, the host of the channel, and I hope you have enjoyed my conversation today with Natale Zappia, author of Traitors and Raiders, The Indigenous World of the Colorado Basin, 1540 to 1859, published by the University of North Carolina Press in 2014. If you'd enjoyed our conversation, we'd appreciate your feedback, and you can reach us by emailing newbooksinlatinostudies@gmail.com or tweeting us or commenting on our Facebook page. Also, if you're interested in purchasing Dr. Zappia's book, you may do so by following the Amazon link on our New Books in Latino Studies page.